The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes, and my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Kevin Magruder. He's got a new book out. It's called Philip Payton, The Father of Black Harlem. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
The last time we had you on was for a book that is directly connected to this one. Do you want to tell us about that first book before we get into this one?
Sure. It came out in 2015, and it's called Race and Real Estate, Conflict and Cooperation in Harlem, 1890 to 1920. And it looks at the period when larger numbers of African Americans are moving to Harlem, which was predominantly white then, and the various relationships and tactics that African Americans use to get anchored there, mainly through real estate purchasing, but also the range of responses from white residents of Harlem to the arrival of these African Americans. And we're much more familiar with the hostile responses and, you know, the resistance. But what I talk about in that book is something that we haven't been aware of so much, is that there was white cooperation as well from residents who sold buildings to African Americans, help them finance by taking back mortgages, and that's not something that you do if you're hostile. Mm-hmm. And so I was really trying to show how it was a much more complicated transition than we think about. And this current book is really a follow-up to that.
And I recall that there was a key component in that. The German Americans were very helpful as far as getting this real estate transferred and breaking up, as you reiterate in this new book, this action by, was it Hudson?
Right, the Hudson Realty Company. There's a pivotal event in 1904. That's the year that the first subway line, what's now the 2 and the 3 line of the subway, was going to open with a stop at 135th Street in Harlem. And in anticipation of that, as typically happens with those kinds of developments, real estate owners are expecting their values of property to increase. And so Hudson Realty, which was a company that had principals of some of the older families in New York, the Morgenthaus, the Bloomingdales of the department store, they began buying up property in the spring of 1904. A fair amount of it was vacant because Harlem at that time was still in development. And then they, for the occupied buildings, they serve eviction notices on the black tenants. And these buildings are, for people who know New York or know Harlem, they're really three streets, 135th Street, 134th, 133rd Street, between Fifth Avenue and Lenox. And so they serve these eviction notices. And probably in the past, people just went quietly. But in this case, they organize, and I haven't been able to determine if they were actually evicted. But what's really clear is that a group of black investors began buying properties, and this is where the German Americans come in because they're the sellers, and it's really a handful of people. But it's significant enough. It's really like a chess game that they buy properties strategically to block what Hudson wants to do, and by the end of that year, Hudson sells the properties they purchased. And Philip Payton was among those people who were buying. And in the summer of 1904, he announces the incorporation of the Afro-American Realty Company with a mission to what he called to eradicate Negro colonization in New York and to make the color line costly. And so there's this flourish of this announcement, and that begins more than a decade of tension, challenges in the community in general. But he's at the center of a lot of that because he's a master of promotion and advertising. And so his name is often attached with the changes. And the way I describe it now is that he brands Harlem for black people before there really are many black people there. And with that formation of that company, he sends the signal, this is where black people will be.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Kevin Magruder. And in that first book, he really is the big player. And that's why you decided this guy needs his own book.
Right, because I found a lot of information. The book wasn't about him, so it didn't make sense to put it in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of other information that was missing about him. Most Harlem histories mention his name, but there's some good reasons why they don't have much more. His nuclear family, he had two brothers, an older sister, none of them had children. And so when you think about kind of who is the keeper of the flame for somebody's legacy, I determined that in this research that he was separated from his wife by the time he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so he died in 1917. He was born in 1876. And so even the business records, his brother-in-law continued to run his business until the 40s, but he didn't have children either.
Mm-hmm.
And so there really, I have not been able to find personal papers or business records. And so what I used a lot is the public records, the real estate transactions, which I used in the first book, because they still tell a fair amount about, like, particularly who is buying what, and often you can determine what they paid for it, and then census records. And then I looked at his family genealogy more, and that really opens up the question of how did he do this. He's 28 when he announces the formation of the company. He died at 42, and so there's this kind of very quick flourish, and then he's gone. But, you know, we're still talking about him today, and if you look at histories of Harlem, they will mention his name. And so this book is really meant to fill that gap to help explain what he was doing. He's in Booker T. Washington's inner circle,
mm-hmm.
Very early on, and that's significant.
His name was Philip Peyton, and the book is Philip Peyton, the Father of Black Harlem. And it really is amazing to read. He had these brothers. They both went to Yale, right?
Correct.
And they died young.
Yes.
He died so young, you wonder if this guy had lived a little longer, what right. he would have done. As it is, he really changed the face of that community, didn't he?
Yes, yes. And when we look at who he was, so the way he talked about who he was, Booker T. Washington from the period 1895 to Washington died in 1915. So there's a 20-year period where Booker T. Washington is at the center of black life in the United States. He's talked about as the leader of black people, and everybody doesn't agree with him because his philosophy is let's focus on savings and work and let's not prioritize voting. And so there's eventually a rivalry with W.E.B. Du Bois.
Mm.
But Peyton is in that circle very early on. And what I talk about in the book, I think what opens that door is his Westfield, Massachusetts roots where he grew up. And there's some relationships there that bring him to the attention of Washington. And so what that means is that, so his brothers went to Yale, but he didn't graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
But what he does is, when he talks about that, he leans in on the high school dropout side of things because there's a Horatio Alger mm-hmm. type of narrative that Booker T. Washington perfects. His own biography, Up From Slavery, was a bestseller. And so as he looks at what African Americans should do, there's this idea you can start with nothing and through hard work and perseverance go forward. And that's what frames his own story. And there's some truth to it. But he, relative to other black people, he starts on, I would say, second base because mm-hmm. he's from an entrepreneurial family. His father is a barber. His mother's a hairdresser. They own a building in Westfield on one of the main streets. So he didn't start from nothing. But it's not like multi-generational wealth that he's able to use. But it does give him an advantage. And so the fact that his brothers went to Yale is unusual. But when we look at the class status that they had, it's not as unusual to think about that. And the fact that Peyton, I believe, he was there's some sibling rivalry that's going on there because he had a brother who's 1 year younger than him. He moves to New York in 1899, right the year that his brother is going to be graduating from Yale. And I'm sure he's thinking, here I am. He's working in his father's barbershop. He's thinking, here I am in the barbershop, and my brother's graduating from Yale with a degree in classics. What am I doing with my life? He pretty much says that at one point. And so all of those things drive him forward.
And even though, as you say, he was born on second base, he's had some struggles early on. You describe how he didn't have the nickel for the streetcar fare, and he'd walk 10 miles home when he's first starting out. And he kind of got his foot in the door in real estate when he got a job as a porter. Now, what does a porter do in a real estate firm?
Anything that needs to be done, from emptying waste baskets to bringing things in, probably even delivering things to offices. It probably is a catch-all term.
Gotcha.
Not sure if it would be custodial duties. And so that does, it really highlights. So yes, his parents were relatively well off, but there's still a racial hierarchy. A black man, particularly without a college degree, even with one, is going to have limited options. Mm-hmm. And Peyton didn't have one. So his options really were those types of jobs. And if he hadn't kind of made a future for himself, that's probably where he would have stayed.
Understood. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'll continue my conversation with Kevin Magruder about his book, Philip Peyton, The Father of Black Harlem, right after this message. The book is Philip Peyton, The Father of Black Harlem, written by Kevin Magruder, who joins us in studio today for the Book Nook. You also make the point that he did some really good things, and he also did some things that maybe could be construed as not so good. Use the term, I think, is it racial capitalism?
Yes.
You want to tell us what you mean by that?
That, in a way, if you think about the conversation that's kind of roiling the nation now, that's been given this catch-all term of critical race theory, and that's really been distorted on what it is. But what people who look at critical race theory are encouraging is a country's values are expressed by its institutions. And so we are a country that was founded with slavery. And that is in our institutions. It's in our laws. It's in our ways of doing transactions. And so for Philip Peyton, coming to New York in 1899, one of the reasons why he has limited choices is because of the obstacles that African-Americans had in terms of acquiring wealth and then transferring that wealth from generation to generation. His parents were born during the period of slavery. I haven't been able to determine exactly whether they were enslaved or not. And so when he moves into New York, it's in that context. He's of the first generation born in emancipation. And so, yes, he can buy buildings, but those German Americans who sell them to him, one of the reasons why they take back mortgages is because it's very unlikely that he could get a loan. And the whole real estate financing of that time is very different than now. A lot of real estate transactions, banks did not, actually even for apartment buildings, they considered them risky. So typically they didn't lend to white or black people. But people would go to estates and borrow money from the estates, or they would go to the seller. And so he does that. And it's, like, it would be hard to verify exactly how race plays a role in it. But if we were living in 1904, we would understand that the places he can go, he can't go to the Vanderbilts. The Vanderbilt estate owned a lot of property in Harlem at the time. Mm. It's doubtful that they might have, he probably went to them because he was that bold, yeah. But it's doubtful that they would have loaned him money. And so that's when, so he's a capitalist in a system that has a racial hierarchy built into it. And some of it is intentional in terms of who people lend to. Some of it is really the result of a legacy of slavery, that if his parents were born in slavery, he and his siblings are the first ones born in freedom. So they don't have multi-generational wealth going back even two or three generations, like the Morgenthaus, yeah. you know, had. And so that's what I mean by that limitation. And that becomes important because he doesn't really do what he says he was going to do with that Afro-American Realty Company, that it was a really inspiring vision of, because what he says is the fact that he's going to do away with the fact that black people and white people cannot live in the same buildings. Uh-huh. And he's really talking about eradicating racial segregation in housing. And it was in New York, the black population was relatively small when he begins. And so it wasn't hardline segregation. So in Harlem, there were apartments where black and white people live in the same buildings, in some cases in the same apartments. But as more black people begin to move to Harlem, those lines get hardened. And he plays a role in doing that. So when we look at the buildings that he does get after 1904, he adopts a practice. These are occupied buildings, so there are white residents in the buildings. He evicts the white mm-hmm. residents and puts in all black residents, and then follows the practice of the time of charging the black residents more than their predecessor white residents would have been charged. And that's why in most cities you would see at that time an area where black people were confined, because they're being steered there so they can be exploited.
Right.
Because if they have limited options, you can charge them more and they will pay because they don't have other options. And so for him to carry out his vision, he would have instead bought those buildings, left the white tenants there, and then maybe as vacancies came up, put in black tenants. He wouldn't have been able to charge them more. And so it would have been a slower process. He would have got less revenue. And because I don't have his business records, I just have to think about what's motivating him, that he is concerned that he doesn't have the cushion that some of his white competitors have. And so I think he could not avoid that allure mm-hmm. of the higher rents. There is something that he is doing that you could say justifies, maybe not justifies, but makes it a rational decision for the tenants, in that Harlem is a new community at that point. What we see of Harlem now, most of that was built in the 1880s, 1890s. That's when the brownstones are being built. So by 1900, 19 to 1910, those buildings are still new. And as black people move into them, it's the best housing they've ever been able to have in New York. They were in Greenwich Village before, then in the Midtown area. Every time those properties are accessible to them, kind of on the kind of secondhand or hand-me-down housing, often on its last legs. Harlem was built for upper middle-class people primarily,
mm-hmm.
and they get that housing stock. And so that is something that, regardless of him fulfilling his vision, that is one of the reasons why he's admired, is because he opened up Harlem to uh-huh. black people. But he does it, but also reinforces the segregation patterns, and right. you know, we're living with the legacy of that now.
Gotcha. And these evictions, of course, of whites got the attention of the media. The New York Times wrote about it.
Yeah.
He had a meteoric career. He was only around for less than two decades doing all this real estate. By the time he died, I think he had $250,000 worth of property, which now would be, what, $50 million probably?
Yeah.
If they were those actual properties in New York, it'd be even more.
Yeah. And one of the things is, it's hard to tell what his wealth was at his death. He died at his summer home in Allenhurst, New Jersey. And I haven't been able to figure out the exact location, but I went to Allenhurst a couple years ago. And it's a community of, it's on the water, and it's these huge Victorian houses. And even now, I think for a black person to be there would be like, But to think that that's where he dies. And the inventory of his estate is missing from the New York City public records.
Interesting.
And so I can't, I have his will. The will doesn't mention assets. The inventory would. And so it's hard to say exactly what he owned at his death.
So he's very mysterious in a lot of ways. You couldn't find his business records. You couldn't find any real personal papers of his.
No.
And yet this guy had a public face. He was a master of advertising.
Yeah. And he was very, very intentional about shaping his image. In the book, he's doing that when he's a child. He did not graduate from high school, but he fashioned a graduation photograph.
Really?
Yes. And and so he's thinking, you know, his brother is already at Yale when he does that. Uh-huh. He dropped out because he had a football injury, and there's other things that I talk about in the book. But he's already thinking about image. Like, I don't know how he used that, but to think that he's probably 19 when he does that. And it says graduation photo on it. And he's doing it at the end of his life, too, is that it shocks people when he died, because the week before there had been a notice in the New York Age that said Philip Payton is under the doctor's care. We expect him to be up and around soon. And I don't know for certain, because at that time sometimes they didn't tell people who were terminally ill that that was their diagnosis. But knowing what I know about him, even if he knew, I don't think he had his biggest deal was in process at his death. And I think he wanted to make sure that that wasn't stalled by people thinking he wasn't going to be around. And so that statement is there 1 week, and the next week he's dead. And so it's a shock to Harlem.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
The book is Philip Payton, the Father of Black Harlem. Kevin Magruder wrote it. And Kevin, speaking of history, and in particular oral history, I would like to talk about this program that you're creating for WYSO. Tell us about it.
It's called Loud as the Rolling Sea, and it draws on oral histories that actually began even before I came to Yellow Springs. I moved here in 2012 to teach at Antioch. And in 2010, a group of residents in Yellow Springs decided to begin taping interviews with people who lived in Yellow Springs, particularly talking about the civil rights era. And it wasn't clear kind of how those were going to be used when it began. When I moved here, I had already been involved in oral history projects in New York, particularly through my church, Abyssinian Baptist Church, which that was Adam Clayton Powell's church. And so it's well known, had a large membership. But we were also thinking about there's some history that we need to capture. And so when I heard about the oral history project here, I was very interested in it. And so I began doing interviews as well. And then with the challenges around racial justice last year, Nina Ellis at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices brought together producers and decided to, she asked me to identify 10 oral histories that I thought would be good ones to start with. And then over the last several months, four of those were edited and put online. And what they're doing is giving us a glimpse of a range of life experiences of people who were in Yellow Springs. And the title comes from the lyric of Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is known as the Black National Anthem, written by James Weldon Johnson and his brother, J. Rosamond Johnson. Coincidentally, James Weldon Johnson was married to Grace Nail. Grace Nail was the sister of John Nail. John Nail worked for Philip Payton. And so James Weldon Johnson wrote a book in 1930 called Black Manhattan. And in that, he talks about the changes in Harlem that will happen eventually. He's kind of prophesying what we're seeing now. So the Oral History Project is really, it's really meant to give us a sense of the life of everyday people, the challenges they had, the triumphs. And it's not that people are stars. That wasn't the criteria for interviewing. Like, everybody has a story to tell. Uh-huh. And that's what we look at. And even with the editing, that was the most challenging thing, because these interviews are hour to hour and a half long. And there are two versions of the edited stories, one about 5 minutes, the other 10 minutes. And they both tell snippets from those interviews. And then eventually we'll have the full interviews available online. And now we're beginning to discuss a second season of interviews for that. And so, you know, I know when I was doing interviews, often people would say, what's going to happen with this? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, maybe it might become, but I couldn't say, yes, we're definitely going to do stories. And so now it's just really great for me to be able to tell people, you know, some of the people have passed away since those were done, but a lot of them are around. And so it's great for them to hear these stories, hear what we've been able to do, and hear it shared with other people. And so I think it gives a fuller picture of African-American life. As a history teacher, there's a challenge with African-American history. It's really what we were just talking about with Philip Payton. As famous as he was, you know, I really had to work to find information on him. Mm. And for people who, if he hadn't used the press in the way he did, it would have been a very different book. And so for other people, often oral history is the way to get those stories. And so I just really believe it's so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to do those interviews while you can, because you never know how long these people are going to be around to talk to you about it. And I treasure some interviews that I did with some Yellow Springs residents who are no longer with us. And I mentioned to you at the post office the other day, mm-hmm. Neil Loving, just yeah. What an incredible guy he was to talk to.
You did interview him?
Yeah, he was on this program.
Oh,
uh-huh. He had a book out and had Virginia Hamilton in a couple times. Mm-hmm. And just amazing to hear these stories and their memories. Mm-hmm. And Neil Loving, wow. Go onto our website, wyso.org. You can listen to these podcasts of Kevin's program, and you can listen to the Book Nook podcast at wyso.org. We've got Neil Loving in there. We've got Virginia Hamilton. We've got Arnold Adolph, who was married to Virginia. Mm-hmm. Did you know Arnold?
I did not know him. I know his son, Jamie.
Okay, Jamie. Uh-huh. Yeah. Jamie's been on this show, too. Mm-hmm. First as a musician, when he still had his band in New York City.
Oh, I didn't know he was a musician.
Yeah. And then he started writing books, and we had him on for a book, and mm-hmm. It's a small world.
Definitely.
Well, we really appreciate you coming in to talk to us about this book, Kevin.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
The book is Philip Payton, The Father of Black Harlem. Kevin Magruder wrote it, and Kevin is at Antioch College. And tell us what you do for Antioch.
I am Associate Professor of History at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. And we have time for one more segment this morning, and I've got a special Book Nook bonus segment coming your way, an interview I recorded back in 1999 with a guest who had just driven in through a blinding snowstorm from Louisville. And he came in and was a real trooper and did his only interview on the program. His name is Henry Winsek, and he had written a history of a prominent Southern family. Have you ever met anyone with the last name of Hairston? Well, it's quite possible that they are related to the subject of this book, The Hairstons, an American family in black and white. And when we did this interview back in 1999, I had several people in Yellow Springs stop me on the street, and they were very excited because they were members of the Hairston family, which apparently is quite a family. And I'll revisit my interview with Henry Winsek, recorded back in 1999, right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, making radio with the community and for the community. It's the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis, and we had a little extra time on the program today. Our first two segments were featuring Kevin Magruder, talking about Philip Payton, the father of Black Harlem. Now we're going to look back at some Southern history, and in particular, a family called the Hairstons. And back in 1999, I interviewed Henry Winsek. He came out to see us here in Yellow Springs. He was on book tour for his book, The Hairstons, and American family that had members right here in Yellow Springs. I remember that the lady who used to run the credit union here in town, her last name was Hairston, and she was very excited about this interview. And I saw her on the 4th of July, and I reminded her, I said, "You remember I interviewed Henry Winsek about the Hairstons?" And she said, "Oh, yes, indeed." She remembered it very well. Let's listen now to the very first part of my interview with Henry Winsek, talking about the Hairstons, recorded back in 1999. It's the best of the book nook. You were working on a totally different project when you stumbled upon the story which ultimately led to this book. Tell us how it happened.
Well, I was traveling across the South to write a book called Old Houses. I was visiting places from Louisiana to North Carolina, old tobacco and cotton and sugar plantations. I was gathering research for a book about families who had stayed in the same houses for many generations. I've always been interested in looking at history from the perspective of families. And as I traveled across the South, I became interested in trying to find a black family who might have maintained a connection to a particular plantation. Because as I went to these places, I heard history from the white point of view. I mean, all of the planter descendants could tell me stories going back to the Revolutionary War. And a lot of their stories figured on the faithful slave who always remained loyal to the family and whom the family loved. And I wondered what history would sound like if I could find a black family who had a strong connection to the past. But as I traveled across the South, I was unable to find one until I got to a place called Coulomie Plantation in North Carolina, just south of Winston-Salem. And Coulomie is owned by a judge, Judge Peter Hairston, as he pronounces it, even though the name is spelled Hairston. Now, and Coulomie was an amazing time capsule. His grandfather had built it just before the Civil War, and it had changed very little. And the judge, like other Southerners I had met, sat me down in the library and told me an hour's worth of stories without stopping, going back to before the Civil War. But then when I asked him the question that had puzzled other Southerners, I said, "What ever happened to your grandfather's slaves?" He said, "Oh, their descendants live all around here. Would you like to meet some of them?" Well, that startled me, and I was even more startled when he simply reached over and picked up the telephone and called a man named Squire Hairston, who came over within a half an hour. And the amazing thing was that as he came into the house, he and the judge greeted each other as old friends. Now, that was something I had not expected to see, because those two men had the closest possible connection to slavery. Squire's grandfather had been the slave of the judge's grandfather. And yet these two men seemed to be good friends and seemed to have been good friends for a long time. Now, I had a sense already from traveling through the South that Southerners, both black and white, are very skilled at putting on a good show for outsiders. So I was a little bit suspicious of this greeting at first. But anyway, the judge left Squire alone with me so we could have some time together. And I asked Squire about his family history. And he talked a little bit about his lineage, but when I asked him what recollections had been passed down from slavery, he got very reticent. I mean, obviously I had touched upon something very painful, and he had no interest in talking about it. And he stood up to signal an end to the interview, but as he was leaving, he seemed to change his mind, and he said, "If you're really interested in my family, why don't you come to our reunion in a couple of months in Baltimore?" Well, that was an invitation I couldn't turn down, even though I didn't really expect much. I didn't know anything about the Hairston family then. I thought there might be 30 or 40 people there when I got to the hotel. Instead, I found nearly 1,000 people from all over the eastern half of the United States and a few even from the West. Now, I should say that the plantation I had visited, Coulomie, was just one small part of a gigantic plantation empire that stretched mainly across three states, Virginia, North Carolina, and Mississippi, and that the white Hairstons had about 45 plantations and may have held as many as 10,000 slaves. So, but every year, Since 1974, the National Hairston Clan, which is the family organization of the Black Hairstons, had been gathering in one place or another, mostly in North Carolina, to celebrate their family strength and to, you know, to give an opportunity for relatives to get together and discuss their history and their heritage. And I was amazed at the strength of family feeling that could bring so many people together across great distances. And I went from one person to the other asking about their backgrounds. And I met, you know, coal miners and teachers and mechanics and businesswomen and businessmen. They represented the whole spectrum of American life. And I realized it was a side of Black America that white America seldom saw. And I was also impressed by their really profound connection to their past, which is something that I resolved to look into.
Hairston, the Scottish forebears who came over and very fortunately settled an area that was very fertile, that was tremendous for growing tobacco.
Right.
They really accumulated some wealth, didn't they?
They certainly did. And that's one of the things that still puzzles me a bit about them. They set about acquiring land as soon as they got here. I mean, they first landed in Pennsylvania, then moved south into Virginia along the Great Wagon Road and migrated first to Albemarle County, then Bedford County, and then ended up in Henry and Pennsylvania counties, and then spread south into North Carolina. They began acquiring a lot of land around the Revolution. But then just after the Revolutionary War, it seems that they had this explosive growth in land and wealth and in the number of slaves that they owned. Exactly how that came about, it still puzzles me. I suspect that they may have helped themselves to some land that was being confiscated from Tories after the Revolutionary War. But it's still a mystery. Their wealth just exploded. And by the 1820s, they were building beautiful houses across southern Virginia and in North Carolina.
And your role in creating this book was very much the role of a detective. You had to do a lot of sleuthing in old records and trying to find people to talk to. And as you got into this, the Judge Hairston, who had been so open and forthcoming with you initially, expressed some fear, didn't he?
He did. He invited me and my family down to Coolamy one Christmas for a Christmas party. And it was a beautiful tree lighting ceremony with guests singing hymns. And before the tree was lit, he was talking privately with my wife in the dining room. And she didn't tell me about it until later that evening when we were leaving. But she said, "Henry, the judge said something very interesting to me before we lit the tree." She said that he had told her, "I'm terrified of what will be in that book." But despite his fear of what I would turn up, he always helped me and he always cooperated with me. Very often we disagreed about the things that I was finding, sometimes strenuously. But he never closed the door. And I think I'm just beginning now to get a sense of why he did that. He had a great uncle named Robert, who was one of the biggest slaveholders in the family. And Robert was driven mad by slavery. This is because his wife had inherited slaves from her father. And two of those slaves were her half-brothers. And those men would have looked just like Robert, because Robert was also related to them. His wife was his first cousin, and I think they were either his nephews or his cousins, or they may have been both. I mean, the family relationship was incredibly tangled. So he was working on a day-to-day basis with enslaved men who were his own blood kin and who may have looked like him. And I think that this began to unhinge him, because he did something that no other Hairston ever did. He set free six slaves in 1832 and snuck them out of his plantation and sent them to Liberia. After that, he had a huge argument with his wife, Ruth, at their mansion in Virginia, And he abruptly jumped onto his horse and left Virginia and rode north and never saw his home there again and never saw his wife again. He rode up to the resort at Saratoga in New York and then to New York City, where he spent a few weeks. And then abruptly he got on a ship and went to Europe for a year. And he wrote back to his nephew, who was the judge's grandfather, also Peter Harston, and said, "I am on the decline. I will never again plague myself about money." He had written earlier to his brother saying that that money would represent the destruction of the family, that greed was killing them, which, of course, to the Harstons seemed the worst kind of heresy because they were great accumulators. They always sought more land, more slaves, more wealth. And for one of their own to say that wealth would be their destruction, they couldn't comprehend that. But Robert spent a year in Europe and then came back to the United States, landing not in New York but in New Orleans. And at first, he planned to go to Texas and disappear onto the frontier. But he changed his mind and went to Mississippi, where he already owned several plantations and had several hundred slaves. And he spent the rest of his life there. He was then in his 50s. And he fell in love with one of his servants. And it was said in the oral history that he regarded her as his true wife and gave her a ring. And then she had a daughter who was Robert's only child, white or black, that we know of. And that this was around 1848 or 1849. And Robert was clearly delighted to have a child at last. And in 1852, he went out on the Tombigbee River to supervise his cotton warehouse there. It was a very unhealthy location, and he suddenly came down with pneumonia. His brother Hardin, who also ran plantations in Mississippi, came to look after him with his son George. And it soon became apparent that Robert was dying. And Robert called in his nephew, George, to his deathbed and said, "I wish to write my will." And he said, "I have a daughter named Krillis, and I set her free, and I give her my estate." And now, so George wrote this down and went in to see his father in the next room, who was Robert's brother, and showed him the document. And Hardin was amazed and stunned by this incredible document, which was giving away a vast fortune to a slave girl, because Robert's estate was worth over $1 million in 1852. So Hardin dashed into the room and screamed at his brother on his deathbed, saying that it was illegal to free a slave in a will, that it was illegal for a slave to inherit or hold property. But Robert said, "George says we can do it. He thinks that there is a way that we can figure it out." But then Robert was really terrified that his daughter would suffer the same fate as the slaves in Virginia, who were very favored slaves. They were managers for the Harstons. One of them was taught to read and write. They were given land of their own by their white father, and yet they remained enslaved. And this terrified Robert. He did not want that to happen to his daughter. So he called a lawyer in, and he dictated almost the same will to the lawyer. He said, "I set my daughter free, and I bequeath to her my entire estate." And then he added something that he had left out the previous day. He said, "I will my body to its mother dust, and my soul to my father, Almighty God." As he was dying, he wanted to die unburdened by the wealth that had driven him so mad. He wished to dismantle his part of the Harston Empire. And the funny thing is, I sense now the same impulse in Judge Peter. I think that's why he welcomed me into his house and introduced me to the black Harstons and encouraged me to look into his past as much as it frightened him, because he wished his legacy to be the dismantling of the Harston myth of the good-hearted, benevolent, mighty slaveholder. I think he wanted to lay that to rest before he went to his grave.
Oh, what tangled webs we weave. The Harstons intermarrying obsessively to consolidate their wealth, obsessively accumulating money, lands, slaves, religiously invoking the Bible as the cause for slavery and the justification for slavery. The
husband and wife separating, Robert and Ruth, and Ruth obsessively not settling the will of, was it her father?
It was her father, yes. She was an extremely shrewd woman. She may have been the largest female slaveholder in the South, owning perhaps about 2,000 slaves. She had inherited large landholdings and slaveholdings from her first husband, John Wilson, who was one of the founders of the city of Danville, Virginia. He died around 1813 when Ruth was about 30, and she had then only one, she had only one child, Agnes. And so she was a very wealthy woman, and she and her first cousin, Robert, got married more or less to consolidate their deed books. This was very common in the Harston family. There were three brothers, Marshall, Samuel, and Robert, all of whom married cousins. And this created a family tree that was incredibly, almost insanely complex, and they weren't the only ones who married first cousins. It was a very remote and isolated part of the world. There were very few choices to be made in terms of a spouse who was on the same social and financial plane as yourself. If you were a Harston, you needed to marry someone who was of the same status and wealth as you, or else you would dilute the family's holdings. And so for that reason, Robert and Ruth married. But the family's obsession with accumulation began to unhinge Robert. And Ruth could sense this. So when her father died and she stood to inherit all of her father's land and slaves, she worried about Robert because, according to the customs and laws of the time, whatever property a woman inherited immediately came totally under the control of her husband, and half of it became his outright to own. And the family was very worried that if Robert got his hands on all of these slaves, that he would scheme to let them go. So she and her and Robert's brother, Samuel, came up with an ingenious plan to keep Robert from getting any part of the inheritance. They simply refused to go to court and qualify as executors of her father's will. So the will never passed through probate. It just remained in limbo. But in the meantime, the plantations were still functioning, and she received the income from those estates and enjoyed all the benefits of them.
That was Henry Winsack, recorded back in 1999, the first portion of an interview I did with him live on the station about his book, The Harristons, An American Family in Black and White. And really a fascinating book, and his only appearance on the program. I don't know what he's been up to the last 22 years, but he's one heck of a writer. And here's a little heads up. The Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock and every Sunday morning at 10:30, and they are completely different programs. So if you listen on Saturday mornings and you weren't aware of the Sunday show, tomorrow, it's going to start early. Why So Weekend usually starts at 10, followed by the Book Nook at 10:30 on Sunday morning. Well, tomorrow, Why So Weekend is going to be on hiatus. They're going to give us the entire hour, so you can tune in for the Book Nook early at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I'm going to have a very special guest joining me in studio, a gentleman who I met on eBay. It's a strange story. I've met authors in some weird places, but he's the only one I've ever met on eBay. He sent me an eBay message, and he said, "You had this record album that you were selling, and I'm wondering if you still have it." And I thought, that was months ago. Who is this weirdo? And so I responded, and I said, "Yeah, I have that record. Do you still want it?" And so I relisted it, and he bid on it, and he bought it for a pittance, and we had a little correspondence, and we discovered that we had some things in common. For one thing, I interview authors, and he has written books, and he's written parody books. This guy is a humorist. He's a comedian. His name is Joe Garden, and for many years, he wrote for The Onion, and he's a very funny guy. He knows everybody, and we're going to talk to him tomorrow at 10 o'clock on our special extended version of the Book Nook Sunday morning from 10 until 11. Tune in. I'll be talking to Joe Garden to start off the program about his humorous books, parody books featuring dogs, cats, and vampires. That's 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening.